Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the author of Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times, Marianne Cooper. Marianne spent 2 years interviewing and shadowing affluent, middle class, and poor families in California's Silicon Valley. She looked at the problems they faced, what they felt anxious about, and the coping mechanisms that they relied upon, tracing the differences caused by earnings, education, gender, and marital circumstances. And she encountered, as you can imagine, all kinds of stories: stoicism, heart-wrenching worry, marital angst, and religious conviction. And the book uses the stories to show how families pursue different kinds of strategies to get by in our safety net less go-it-alone age. Marianne is a sociologist at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University and an affiliate at the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. She was the lead researcher for the bestseller Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Marianne. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Marianne. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You start the book with this incredibly dramatic story about a 62-year-old man who lost his job and the plan that he came up with to get by until he was old enough to receive Social Security.
Yeah, it's a really amazing story.
Yes.
His name is Timothy Bowers, and as you said, he was 62 years old, and he got laid off from his job as a driver for a drug wholesale manufacturer. And he struggled to find a good job with benefits for 3 years. And after a fruitless search, he came up with this plan to get by until he was old enough to receive his full Social Security benefits. And his plan was that he went down to a local bank, and he handed the teller a stick-up note for $80. And he got the money, and then he handed the money over to the security guard and waited for the police to arrive and arrest him. And at his trial, he told the judge that, you know, going to jail for 3 years, especially if it were a minimum security prison, would suit him just fine, because upon his release, he would be old enough to get the benefits through Social Security that he was missing. So The New York Times described what he did as, you know, an honest-to-goodness visionary in the realm of retirement planning, which is a pretty sarcastic way to describe it. But his lawyer saw it as something else. He saw it as a sign of the times. And after looking for a job for so long and never finding one a good one that came with benefits, he finally said, to hell with it.
Yeah. What a story. So he got his wish. We'll get out in 3 years and be on Social Security. I'm sorry.
And that's why I wrote the book, is to understand how someone could come to feel that going to jail would be a birthday gift.
Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting study that you've done here, because it required so much work. And when I think about how you entered the lives of all of these people, you were privy to marital disagreements and their deepest worries about how they were going to be able to fund a retirement or send their children to college or scrape together enough money to pay the rent. You were really involved in very central parts of their lives.
Yeah, I wanted to go behind the statistics documenting these trends. We know that inequality is on the rise. We know insecurity is on the rise. That story is told through charts and graphs, and I felt like the human face of it needed to be told. So I wanted to go and talk with people who live out these trends in their daily lives. And so I did interviews with families, but I also followed a smaller group of families around. I ate dinner with them. I went to their kids' soccer games. I washed the dishes with them after dinner, all of those things to get a more intimate look into their life.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the Little League field, because that's where you got a lot of the families. And it's an interesting story, because you had two teams playing, one in an all-star game, I believe, and one was from wealthy families and the other was more working class families. And the wealthy families won the game big time, and we'll understand why. But that was an interesting place to find participants, wasn't it?
Yeah, I stumbled onto this recruitment strategy. One of the biggest hurdles to doing a study like this when you need people from different income and wealth levels is figuring out which group people are in, because you don't go up to strangers and say, "Hi, I'm Marianne. How much do you earn?" It's just not normal.
Right.
So I interviewed a woman named Laura Delgado who worked as a cashier at a big box store. And afterwards, she invited me to go to this all-star game that her son was playing in. And so I found myself sitting in the stands with her on a June evening, and one of the kids hit a foul ball, and it went into the area where the other opponent's team's cars were. And Laura said, "Oh, those are really fancy cars." And I looked over and noticed that they were all, you know, BMWs or Mercedes. And I said, who are they playing? And she named a city, one of the most affluent in Silicon Valley. And I realized in that moment that on the baseball field, it was a miniature version of the larger story I was trying to tell. And so when I was riding home with Laura in her sort of old beaten up minivan with a crack in the window, I wondered what it would be like if I were going home with one of the opposing team's family.
Right.
And then that's when I realized this is a great way to recruit families. So I went around to a lot of different tournaments in Silicon Valley, and I could tell from the neighborhood the team was from what the likely income and wealth level of that family was. So a core group of families was recruited that way.
Yeah. And I was just, this is just a sidebar thing, but those families would spend $100 to $200 in hour for a baseball coach?
Yeah. So as I explained in the book, Laura's son's team from this working class neighborhood in Silicon Valley, when they were on the field, they were like the bad news bears. They were completely unorganized.
Yeah.
And even though this was supposed to comprise the best baseball players from their town, whereas the affluent families, those kids were like a well-oiled machine. Everything was super organized, and the final score was really lopsided. It was like 13-3, and so I was kind of surprised by that, since all of these kids are supposed to be really good at baseball. But then subsequently, I learned that the affluent children often have professional baseball coaches, many of whom are former professional players, and those coaches cost $100 to $200 an hour.
Mm, goodness
so
gracious!
So the lopsided score. It wasn't so surprising after I learned that.
And when you delve into the lives, it's not as though those who are very wealthy don't have their own set of insecurities, but they're so wildly different than poor families and what their insecurities are, or even middle-class families. So some of the wealthy families were dealing with making sure that you take the right high school courses to get into not just a state university, but to really have a good shot at the very good life. It has to be way above that.
Right. The biggest finding was that from talking with families from rich to poor, you know, from technology executives to domestic workers, is that we're all weighed down by something very similar, which is the anxiety generated in hard times. So all these families, they feel insecure, they just feel it and deal with it differently. And that's what you're outlining here, is that the top, even though they have a lot of money and a lot of resources, they really wanted more and more. In response to the insecurity that they saw around them and in our country, they really wanted to create a firewall to protect their families from it. In response to all of this, middle-class and working-class families were doing something very different, which was just trying to eke out an existence. They lowered their expectations because they realized there wasn't much they could do about their situations, and they just tried to get used to less. And what this points to is that the dividing lines in our country are not just economic ones, they're also emotional in terms of what we feel about security, our expectations, our hopes, and also our dreams.
Mm-hmm. And you also make it personal because you describe, and what a moment this must have been, you just delivered your daughter and the recession hits, the stock market goes way down, and there's your husband. You have a picture, I believe, of your husband who's looking at a computer, seeing what's happening to you financially, and you're so wiped out because you just had a baby, for heaven's sake, that you don't know what's going on. But a picture really described that moment in time for a whole lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, personally, you know, I'd gone out and I'd done all this research, and then we had our first child, and the day we brought her home from the hospital, that's in October of 2008, the stock market was crashing. That's when everything that we'd been kind of seeing happen just exploded. And I captured this picture of my husband cradling our daughter in his lap, and he was looking at the computer, and I thought it was this really sweet moment between them. But later, when I looked at the picture, I realized that I had recorded something else entirely, which is that behind my husband on the computer screen is the S&P 500, like a picture of a graph of it falling off the cliff. And we had just received word the week before our daughter was born that there was bad news at the biotech company my husband worked at, and that a trial for a drug had failed, and that meant a lot of people were going to lose their jobs. And finding a job is hard, usually, but finding one amidst that slide is even harder. Mm-hmm. And so that picture with that graph behind him and my husband's face was so serious and worried. And I realized I had recorded history not just through the downward arc of the S&P 500, but also through the worry etched onto my husband's face. And that's the story I wanted to tell in the book. It's not just the graph, because I think we have a lot of information on the graph, but we need more information about the worry on people's faces.
Yeah. And you must have thought, and he must have thought, as your daughter was just home from the hospital, what is her life going to be like?
Yeah, I think, you know, I started this project before I had children, and now I have two. And so much of the worry I have about my children is bound up in the worries we all have. And the problem is that then it becomes kind of a singular focus just on our families and our experience.
Yes.
But really,
right.
We're all united
right.
in this worry. We're doing it separately, and it can feel very alone and feel very isolating, but we're all worried about exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about Laura Delgado, because she describes, just in terms of her life, the way she grew up and the way she's living now, and she's had some rough times, but it really encapsulates what's happened with different generations. She had, as she might describe it, a fairly charmed childhood. Describe her father's work, why it was charmed, and what happened.
Right. So she grew up in a solidly middle-class family in Silicon Valley, and her father was a firefighter, and her mother had a part-time job working at a local school, and they had a very middle-class existence, enough money to pay the bills, enough money to set aside some savings, and enough money to send their kids to local state universities.
Mm-hmm.
And then in one generation, Laura experiences immense downward mobility. And one of the main things that happened is that her family was on the front lines of what we call a shift in risk. So it used to be that we shared risk with our employers. They paid good wages and provided employees with good benefits. And in return, employees worked really hard and used their talents to build a company. And all of that began to unravel as you think of the shift from pensions to 401ks, or companies used to offer health benefits and then they stopped. At one point in time, Laura's husband was employed with a company that didn't offer health insurance. And sadly, the worst happened. And Laura had a seizure while she was driving her car and crashed and had suffered really severe internal injuries. And fortunately, she recovered. But when she left the hospital, she was $50,000 in medical debt. And so for a family that was just barely making ends meet to begin with, that $50,000 in debt became too much to bear.
Right. And then things kind of went downhill from there, too, in terms of the marriage, in terms of what she had hoped for her children. But you've done some follow-ups and where they wound up. You just don't, it's really hard to get something different for your children or for yourself.
Yeah, it's in Laura's case, it's like the economic punches kept coming.
Mm-hmm.
So they had the medical debt, and then her husband experienced long-term unemployment. And then housing costs are so high, they couldn't afford a home. And so then they had to, you know, go in the rental market, which in Silicon Valley is so expensive. They could never get ahead, and they were falling further and further and further behind. And this doesn't just affect parents. It also affects their children. And so in all the years that I've known them, their children have never had the kind of economic opportunity that children from wealthier families get. So none of their children, and now they're in their early 20s, ever thought about going to college, ever applied to go to college, because they knew they didn't have the resources to do that. So whereas in Laura's life, when she was younger, her parents could afford to send their kids to a local state college because it was affordable. In her lifetime, she can't do that for her kids.
Yeah, and it seems to be a theme among some families in this middle-class bracket that all they can hope for is that they'll get financial assistance.
Yeah, you know, what I found is that families have really let go of their hopes, and they're actually, what they're trying to do is make insecurity seem a lot more tolerable. So Laura, you know, when I first met her, she was in the midst of separating from her husband, and so she, on top of it all, was becoming a single parent. And oftentimes she didn't have enough money to pay the electricity bill. And so at one point in time, the heat gets turned off. And she said, but it's okay. It's like we're camping. So what she's doing in that moment is repackaging symbols of insecurity, like a lack of heat, and saying, no, it's not that bad. It's really just about family bonding. We're having a fun time. So putting a rosy gloss on something that's actually really, really sad, which is that she was slipping into poverty.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to a family that really has been experiencing poverty. I can't remember their names. The Samoan family?
Mm-hmm, the Flaus.
Flaus, yeah. They came here with not very much. They were living on not very much at all, right?
Yeah, they were, but in many ways they were better off than Laura Delgado. Mm. And that's because they had the support of their church. So one of the things I learned from talking with working class and poor families who are in the middle of really difficult economic times is how much their faith in God and their churches really helped sustain them. So their churches would provide basic needs like food, shelter, and clothing. The Flaus, their church gave them diapers when they needed it and helped them on their rent a couple times when they were short. But another thing that was really, really comforting was their belief that God had a plan for them, and that God would return their faith with material blessings. And many times Laura would say to me, you know, when things get really hard, I pray, and I know that the Lord will provide a way for me. And so they had this sense that it would all work out. And when you're in these really, really difficult economic circumstances, having that belief enables you to get by.
Mm-hmm. And some of their children have gotten by, right? Their older children?
Yeah. So they were members of a Mormon church. And the Mormon faith, as many listeners may know, is one of the fastest growing religions in this country. And they have a belief that their members should be interdependent and be able to rely on each other. But that means that everyone needs to be self-sufficient. So one of the ways that the members of the church are helped is that the church will give out resources, again, like diapers or help people if they're short on their rent. But they also believe in education as the path to self-reliance. And so their children were given scholarships to attend college for several years each in order to enable them to move up the class ladder, become more self-sufficient. So the Flaus children are actually getting something that the Delgado's children are not.
Mm-hmm. Except perhaps for the youngest daughter, whose mission in life is to make sure that she takes care of her parents when they are old.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much she's believing in that, but it's certainly in that culture, it's an expectation that the youngest daughter takes care of the parents as they age. And that was a definite theme. And part of the way this family went about conceptualizing their path to security in old age was that their daughter would take care of them.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. Marianne Cooper is our guest. She said she wrote the book because she wants to explore what's keeping Americans up at night. And inequality and insecurity, we've done many shows on those issues, have been on the rise. And so what she did was seek out 50 families in the Silicon Valley, some poor, some middle class, some rich, because she wanted to put actual people into this story so we get an actual feeling of what people are dealing with when it comes to housing or food or education for their children. How are families responding to these forces, and how are they coping in these times that aren't very easy for many? So we welcome your phone calls. You can put a human face on these stories as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Marianne is a sociologist at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University and an affiliate at the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. She was the lead researcher for Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead, and she received her PhD in sociology from the University of California, Berkeley. Phone lines are open. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Marianne Cooper. She is the author of Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Hi, Marianne. Hi, Joy. Hi. I just wanted to say that pretty much going through right now what you know, you guys have been, girls have been discussing is I'm 45 years old and I need bypass surgery in my femoral artery. And just found out our work is going to be shut down by December. And it's a real good job and real great benefit. And, you know, I just think within 6 months, my leg's been deteriorating. It's going to do an about face from anything we've been used to lately. And it's just my worries is for the children and, you know, my wife. And I do worry about stress tearing us apart, you know, and I hope it doesn't happen. But, you know, things are getting stressful, but decisions we got to make.
And the surgery will happen before the place closes, Mike, or after?
That's what I'm figuring out right now. Short-term disability is something is nice, and I did opt for the higher payout knowing my health condition, but it's still it's almost half my wage. And so, you know, that I'm just trying to factor in now whether I'll be better off to go on that or you know, waited out to the end because we do have a bonus and severance pay, but we've got to stick it out to the end.
Right. Oh, yeah, those are hard times, Marianne.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear about your situation, and it's so difficult. And just know that you're not alone, because your story is the story of most Americans. And this is the issue: is that families have to fill the gap between what they earn and what they need. And I call this security work or worry work. And families have always had to do security work. But in our time, this task of managing insecurity has become harder and more unpredictable for a larger number of families. As the caller is illustrating, families don't have anchors anymore that they can steadily rely upon. And when something outside of their control happens, like a health condition, they're more and more on their own to figure out how to deal with it. And this is called the shift in risk, where employers used to share risk with us more. And now, as you know, this layoff is about to happen, he's going to be increasingly on his own to figure it out. This is, I believe, the moral question of our time, is what we're going to do as a society to help families deal with these moments, because more of us are experiencing them, and they're on their own to cope and figure out, and it's extremely difficult. And his concern that this is going to tear apart his family or cause his wife stress is a real one, because this it's like an emotional waterfall, right? Something economic happens, and then it stresses the parents out, and then that in turn stresses the children out.
Right.
It's not the right way that I think are not the right direction for our country to continue to go in.
Yeah. All the best to you, Mike. That's a rough one. Let's go to Jess in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. How you doing today?
All right, Jess. How are you?
So far, so good. I have one of those unfortunate sob stories as well. I've had 9 surgeries. I have 6 children. My wife left about a year and a half ago, and I have the children, and I'm retaining them in the divorce. But I'm working jobs where I'm just trying to get by. But my question is, how much of the so-called free market economy has to do with this gap between the struggling working class, the working poor, the so-called middle class, which is basically nothing left at this point? I mean, when you're spending $4 for a gallon of milk and a gallon of gas and a loaf of bread each, there's no money when you're making $8, $9, $10 an hour.
Yeah.
And this is ridiculous. How much of the free market economy has a play in this?
Yeah, I think this is another big conversation, is when our economic system is continuing to go in this direction in which there's growth, but all the benefits of that growth go to corporations and people who are already at the top. What's different today about how it used to be is post-World War II, up through the 1970s, as the economy grew, workers also, their incomes also grew. So as a result of rising productivity, everyone benefited, everyone prospered. And then what the caller is really pointing to is that the economy is growing, that we're having more instability, but we're everyday workers are not sharing in that growth. Increasingly, all of the benefits are going to corporations and, again, people who are already doing quite well. And that leaves families to try to survive and struggle, as these calls are illustrating. So I think this is, again, a question about how we're going to set families up for success. Because when families don't have enough money to buy the things that they need, they turn to credit. And we saw how that worked last time, which is that when families take on too much debt, they buckle under the weight of that debt, and then our economy falls apart. So families really lead the economy. And research is starting to show that family and that countries that are characterized by high levels of inequality can't sustain economic growth. I mean, I think what the caller's pointing to is that we are literally eating our consumer base alive. And that is bad news for a consumer-driven economy.
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Jeff. I'm getting really sad listening to everybody. Oh, man. Thanks, Jess, very much for your call. What happens to, and this has been the case with some of the families you were with, they get pretty far in debt and they can't, you know, make the rent or something that's crucial and the bill collectors are calling. How long can you let the phone ring knowing it's a bill collector and not pick up?
I think a lot of families screen their calls for bill collectors. Bill collectors can be very aggressive in coming after the debt, and it's very draining emotionally and psychologically to have to take a call from someone when you don't really have a lot of control over your economic circumstances. You can't just run out and get a job that's going to enable you to pay the debt back. Mm-hmm. So this is a lot of families were dealing with that.
Carla is next in La Crosse. Hi, Carla.
Hello. I'm calling because my concern is that in order to secure your situation in life, you either have to have a lot of income from a job, or you have to be wealthy in order to pay for in order to have insurance. Mm-hmm. So that leaves many people who are unemployed without a method of paying for their medical expenses, which can lead to poverty. And so I think, do you have any suggestions? Do you think single payer would be a good way? I think that's at least one thing that people wouldn't have to worry about if they are unemployed.
Yeah, I think health insurance is one of the biggest obstacles for families. I mean, to deal with the fact that we're pulling apart as a country, we have to pull together. And part of doing that is realizing that it absolutely does not have to be this way. So when people experience insecurity, they often experience it as sort of a personal failure, like they could have prevented it or done something different. But it's not that people have done something wrong. It's that policy has failed us. And policy ushered in this age of insecurity. And I think policies like the one that the caller is referring to are going to get us out of it. I think we need to return to a set of values that drives our policies, values that led to the creation of a middle class in this country. And those values are that we are better off when we stand together. We're better off when we provide security to one another in both good times and bad. And this leads to certain policies like widely available, affordable health care, affordable child care, affordable college educations. These are the kinds of foundational building blocks that families need to have economic security, and it's economic security that enables economic opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the very wealthy for a moment, because I wonder if part of the problem is that some of the people you interview just don't have, forgive my being too judgmental if I am, I'm just posing the question, much empathy for all the other people who are really struggling to get by. So it was striking to me that what is of concern is making sure that you take all the right courses in high school so that you can get into not just a good state university, but you have to get into a very good university, taking your trips, your children all over Europe because they want them to see how maybe poor people live in India. I don't know. But it's a whole different set of concerns, and I'm wondering if maybe there needs to be more concern for the other people you wrote about.
Yeah, I guess I would not characterize it as a lack of empathy. So the affluent families that I came to know did not think that the U.S. was headed in the right direction either. And they were very concerned about this hollowing out of the middle class, noting that countries that don't have a strong middle class can become really unstable. But their personal response to it was to make sure that their families and their kids were going to be okay.
Right.
And what that led to was what I call an upscaling in expectations about security and definitions of security. They were very, very concerned about where their children were going to end up and what they saw as an increasingly competitive and globalized world. And to, they would say things like, you know, my kids no longer have an advantage just because they're American, because of the rise of India and China. So what that meant is that these children needed to be positioned to compete in this world. And that led to expectations about them going to the best schools in the country, not just for college, but also they had to have a graduate degree, because for a lot of these families, that they've come to the conclusion that a college degree is like what having a high school degree used to be, right? It's just, it's no longer enough. And so it does create a lot of anxiety in these families, because as they're trying to, even if they are, I think they were sensitive to the issues that other families with less means have, but they also were very concerned that their children not end up being as insecure as all these as everyone else has become. And so it was a singular focus. I think the main thing is everybody is head down looking at their own situation and trying to survive it. And that's what's leading to a lack of a demand for anything to change.
And who did most of the worrying? Who did most of the financial worrying and keeping track of everything? Was it the female of the family or the male of the family?
Well, this is a question about social class. So what I learned from affluent families is that it's fathers who are largely responsible for the economic planning in those families. And it's a long range. I call them security projects that families are thinking about. They wanted to make sure that their kids were okay, that they were okay in retirement. So a lot of planning. But as you move down the class ladder, that sort of role in family life shifts. And so among middle and working class families, among the families I talked with, it was the women who became what I called the designated worrier in their family. So they were the person who was the security guard in their family, who was on call to right the family ship when something went wrong. And so because families are increasingly likely to experience a destabilizing event, these women had a lot of work on their plate. So not only were they doing more of the second shift, like the childcare and the housework, they were also doing more of what I call the insecurity shift. And this led to them being extremely stressed out. And, you know, a lot of mothers told me that they lost sleep at night, or they had become depressed, or they had heart palpitations. Gina Califato, who in the book is the mother that I used to illustrate this story, and she had insomnia. And the first time I interviewed her, she had been awake since 3 a.m, worrying about how she was going to deal with the fact that her company was faltering and she was getting pay cut after pay cut. Mm. So women are really, when it comes to real insecurity in this country, women are the ones who are charged with dealing with it. They figure out when it's time to file or declare bankruptcy or foreclosure. They're the ones who deal with the bill collectors, and they deal with the depression and stress related to that.
We welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. We're speaking this hour with the author of Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. Marianne Cooper is our guest, and Marianne is a sociologist. She's at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University and an affiliate at the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. She spent a 2-year period of time, and she did follow-ups with the people that she studied, 50 families from the Silicon Valley, from very wealthy parts of the Silicon Valley to not as wealthy. So we're looking at poor families, middle-class families who are really right on the edge, and those families who are doing very well, finding out what their insecurities were and looking at it somewhat historically, because things certainly have changed. So we're not living in our parents' world anymore, where, you know, usually dad went to work and did okay, jobs that didn't require college educations, and moms may have worked part-time, or some did work full-time, but the income that one person used to generate for the household was enough for people to get by. And has that ever changed? So the sense that from all the people that she interviewed, that people are really taking on these issues that are of deep concern. It makes them very anxious. And as you heard her say, you stay up at night, you're figuring out, where are we going to get the money for this? And we're all kind of separated from each other. So we're going it alone instead of helping each other. And that's what we're talking about. And you're letting us know that indeed this is an accurate description from those who have called. Our phone number, we have lines open for you right now if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest this hour is the author of Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. Marianne Cooper is with us. Here's an email that's come in, Marianne. Carl thinks that people who go on disability might be finding ways to stay on disability as a way to have security. Did you find this?
I personally didn't find it, but we are seeing a growing proportion of men with lower levels of education who are on disability. And the analysis is pointing to the way in which this functions as a source of support for them. They may, in fact, have a disability, but we know that the proportion of people who are claiming the disability is growing. And there are very few safety nets to turn to, and I think all of these things are little glimpses into that, that we're, when we have to respond to these, you know, growing forces of inequality and insecurity, we not only do different things, like affluent people will make contributions to their 401ks, and people like Laura Delgado will go without health insurance, and other people might rely on disability to get by. But we also rely on different kinds of emotional coping mechanisms, and that's the angle that I was exploring in the book.
Yeah. Did many of the people, those who were really financially strapped, go to their parents for help?
Yes. And Laura Delgado's case, her parents often over the course of her life have given her resources or a little bit of extra money to help her weather the storm. And what's interesting is that that's what they were able to develop and, you know, accumulate some resources because they were in a different generation in which there was a lot of, you know, sort of mobility for families like that she came from. And that now that's sort of the safety net for families like Laura's who no longer have what her parents had.
Right. Liz in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I just turned this on the radio, and it's funny because I'm driving to pick up my kids from school. I'm a full-time working mother and a husband who works on opposite shifts, and this is how I take my lunch hour, driving 20 minutes in town and heading home. But I have to read this book. I can so relate. In my 30s, things were so much better economically for us. And in our 40s, I have gained, you know, a lot of weight, many sleepless nights. I've had to really shoulder all the burden of worry of how, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul, how are we going to make the next paycheck. And, you know, this is a very real anxiety for many, many women. My mother had the luxury of going back to work when we were all in school. I've always had to work. I hold two jobs. My husband finally had a really good paying job, and then his company completely closed and gave him a week's notice. So we started all over again. So it's, you know, it's a real struggle, and you do have to look for every possible way to cut costs to make ends meet, and you'd like to be the parent that would live comfortably, but times have really, really changed, and it's a constant struggle. And it affects you not only mentally, but physically as well.
What do you think, and this is a huge question, and there are a lot of parts to it, but if there were one thing that you could say, I really need this, and then things would be easier for me, one job that paid pretty well, or a promise of long-term employment for your husband, or what?
I think a job that really, really paid well. Mm-hmm. And when my husband lost his job, you know, we were lucky that I carried the benefits.
Yes.
And he has a job now, but, you know, we're missing a massive amount of income that, you know, we still have the same bills that we used to live off. So that's become extremely fun in being creative. And but there's also some value in working for a good company, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really hard to say what would give you in this ever-changing world a peace of mind. I don't know if I really have an answer.
Yeah.
I think it's not one thing, and that's the issue, is that families need a few different things coming together to give them the foundation that they need. And what the caller is pointing to are a few larger trends that are worth pointing out. So women are now breadwinners or co-breadwinners in two-thirds of American families. They are really the economic backbone now of the majority of American families. And so they, as they've stepped into this provider role, that comes with a lot of sleepless nights, especially because insecurity is on the rise. And then couples are having to, you know, navigate economic blow after economic blow, like the caller's pointing to, and it creates a lot of stress in their daily lives, for sure. But the other issue that's compounding this is that when Americans lose jobs, they're now unemployed for longer periods of time, and for many of them, when they find a new job, their job pays less than it used to. So that exacerbates the issue. So not only are they out of work and their incomes are lower, but then it's not just a bump in the road, because when they get another job, it compounds the problem. So it's like a long-term structural readjustment that a family is having to go through.
Thank you so much, Liz, for your call. Let's go to Dave in Peterborough. Hi, Dave.
Yes, good afternoon. You know, I've been listening to the show here as I drive in my car, and pretty much agree with everything I've been hearing. And, you know, I'm a middle-class individual, and I share a lot of the same anxieties that you've been talking about that the middle class has. And one of the big anxieties that I have, I think, which has also been shared, is the whole idea of health care insurance. And, you know, I have a wife who had a kidney transplant a number of years ago. She's doing fine. She's perfectly doing very well with her transplant and everything. But you live with this dark cloud over your head that if you ever lose your job or anything else, how do you make it without health insurance in this country? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that I just wanted to make a comment on is I don't see a lot of middle class and working class people who vote and do things that are within their own self-interest either. And what do I mean by that? I mean, we have a president, and I'm neither saying I like or dislike our president, but we had an Affordable Care Act that was passed that to help us be able to have and afford insurance. With a lot of protections that were passed. And yet routinely, if you take a survey of Americans and say, are you for or against the Affordable Care Act? You know, a large majority of Americans, it's not just wealthy, but as a whole say, no, we're not for it. What, I don't understand that. You know, you don't want to have access to health insurance and health care. This is one of the things that would help give you some access.
Marianne.
Yeah, I think this is really an important part of the story. Which is that as we're all trying to adapt to and cope with these alarming economic trends, something interesting happens. And I saw this with Laura Delgado, which is that her ability to sort of talk herself through the insecurity she faced actually led her to compensate for the very inequality that created the hardship she has to endure. So instead of saying, you know, I can't believe that I didn't have health insurance and now I'm under the weight of $50,000 in debt, she blamed herself. And what this does is that it prevents her towards taking a critical stance towards the system that created all this difficulty for her. And so Laura responds in that way, and talking herself through this insecurity and making it seem not as bad as it actually is. And then you've got people on the other hand in the book like Paul Ma, who is a technology executive, and even though he has over $1 million in assets, he told me he was still worried and that he needs to get to somewhere around a net worth of $10 million before he feels like he's going to be completely financially secure. So what happens is you have like people like Paul Ma who are pushing for more and more. So in response to insecurity, the rich don't think they have enough and are striving to attain more.
Right.
And middle and working class families like Laura Delgado's lower their expectations and try to get used to less. What this does is it actually makes inequality worse. And then because we're all so busy treading water in our separate ponds trying to cope with all of this, we fail to come together with the collective will to stop it. And so I think the caller is making a really important point, mm-hmm. which is that we need to stop looking at our own individual situations and be head down and just trying to think that we can, if there, I saw a lot of families like, maybe if I just save more, if I just did this, I could overcome the insecurity I'm facing. And what that prevented them from seeing was that, no, it's these outside social forces that are creating this situation for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's public policy that's creating this mm-hmm. situation for you. And so if people could begin to connect their individual personal experience with these larger social forces, I think that would create a perspective where they would demand change.
You know, and you wish that. It's been my observation that there aren't very many politicians because of the way our political structure is structured, that people have to depend on those with vast amounts of money, lobbyists or Wall Street bankers or whatever, to get reelected so they can continue with their careers. And very few are addressing all of these issues that are in your book. Where is the political discourse about all of this? Where are there people who are standing up and saying, we understand what's going on with you. Can we help?
Yeah, I think there is a lack of it. I think there are some people who are trying and trying very mightily to do this. There is a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of, I think, skepticism among Americans about political figures because of partisanship and other things. But this is the future of our country, and I think this is the moral question of our time. It's how we're all going to respond to this. The trajectory we're on is actually a very scary one. If, you know, the United States is now one of the most unequal countries, in a study that looked at 9 countries around the world in terms of social mobility, we were 8th out of 9th. So if you want to achieve the American dream, you probably should go abroad. And so I think politicians are clinging into this. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is on the forefront of advocating for policies and for change that will help middle-income Americans. But I do think that it is also incumbent on average Americans to hold their politicians accountable.
Yes.
And say, are you supporting policies that decrease risk for families?
Right. Dave, thanks. Jane in Appleton, hi.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Jane.
Okay. I graduated from college in the 70s, and one of the keynote speakers at commencement indicated that all of you, your mothers and fathers will all be better off than these upcoming generations. And the speaker was absolutely correct in that. As you take a look around the landscape of Wisconsin, and you see how we've lost our manufacturing, and, you know, manufacturing has provided very good livings for many people in Wisconsin, and the hourly rate, pensions, time and a half. And just a side note on that, maybe thank you to unions. But you see, you can see now, and it's that change from manufacturing to service, and certainly, you know, there are professional jobs as well that there's a change in. But part of this is, take companies in Germany that take their workforce and they have a change in their labor market or their way they manufacture or do things, they will educate their workers. Here in the United States, we throw them out the door, get rid of them, ski around. There is not a safety net for that re-education. So certainly there's a Trade Readjustment Act, but the jobs that are again available are service jobs. They're not going to pay as well. They don't have benefits. Secondly, you know, the whole insurance industry has just scammed every person out there. Seriously, what has happened in our lifetime when we had maybe a single payer program or an insurance? And the thing that HMOs has done is managed to take more money out of our pockets. When I lay down the last 30 years of my insurance rates, it shocks me. And my heart bleeds for people that can't even afford insurance anymore.
Marianne.
Yeah. Yeah. It's this is all a pretty sad story, and it really started to emerge in the 1970s. And, you know, at this point, we've reached a new historic record where 76% of Americans lack the confidence that their children's generation is going to do better than their own. And there are a lot of reasons for this. The caller is pointing to the decline of unions, which is a huge part of the story. We have, our lowest on record rate of unionization in the sense that only 11% of employed workers are represented by a union. And that means workers have lost leverage to collectively bargain for better wages and working conditions. But really underneath all of this, there's been a change in the values in our country. And it used to be that we could stand together and provide security for one another. And then we started to move towards a belief that people were really better off on their own. I think the data is telling us they're not. And that's the moment we're in, and we need to figure out how to fix it. And it is a depressing story, but it's less depressing when you realize, again, that it just doesn't have to be this way.
Marianne, thank you so much for being with us. Important conversation. Marianne Cooper, the book is Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour. Next week, we'll be speaking with Dr. Stephen Hargarten about the costs associated with gun violence. And we'll talk about the new PBS series on the Roosevelts. John Gerda will also join us, Milwaukee historian, as we look at Open Doors Milwaukee. It's around again. How could a year have gone by so quickly? So great conversations ahead and next week. Thank you so much for listening.